The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the September 16th, 2013 edition of The Heretics Hour. Tonight, I will look further into the relationship between Adolf Hitler, National Socialism, and Christianity. You might think I've said everything there is to say about it, or everything I might be able to say about it, but I have not. So I think tonight's going to be an interesting program. I don't have many listeners yet, though, so people are maybe a little tired out from this, but I think it's going to turn out to be a good show. First, I'd like to make some opening remarks about our dear Federal Reserve. And speaking of finance, I want to thank some recent financial contributors, either to my website or to the White Network. They are Graham and Robin, Dimitar, Mihaly, Thomas, Franklin, and another person who doesn't want his name mentioned. Thanks to all of you very much. We couldn't do it without you. The problem is Jews. Have you got that yet? People clamp their ears against that. I've been seeing that lately. They will not hear it. Why is that? Jews have manipulated their minds, that's why. But I'm going to start by talking a little about Jewish government ruling over non-Jew people. That's us. And where do we see that more clearly than in the financial world? Someone wrote recently, government started with the recognition of the law of reciprocity. It is the underlying rule governing human affairs. You don't kill me, and I won't kill you. You don't steal my stuff, and I won't steal your stuff. Well, this idea is actually very European, but in general, though, not exactly perfected, it can be considered universal. And I read something on Thursday. I'm trying to pay attention to financial matters a little bit. And it was titled The Inconvenient Debt, and talking about the raising of the debt ceiling. Said the final cost of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars will be between $4 and $6 trillion, according to a new study out of Harvard, and most of those costs have yet to be paid. So if it comes from Harvard, must not be an exaggeration, must be something that we have to know, you know, that we're going to be facing. And, excuse me, you know the way that they discuss, the way they talk between $4 and $6 trillion, it's like between $2 and $4. I mean, the vast, huge difference between $4 trillion and $6 trillion is $2 trillion, which we can't even really imagine. But it's somewhere in there. They don't have it worked out any closer, any tighter than that. But they're really referring to, in large part, to veterans' medical bills that will have to be paid in the future. So you see that even when we raise the debt ceiling, as we've always done, 94 times since 1944. And what happened in 1944? They knew they were winning the war, that's when it started, because there are a lot of debts to be paid. And so this will be the 95th time, and it won't be the last time. Because every time you do it, you know you're going to do it again, because you have to do it again, because they don't deal with the problem. So it will continue to get raised, the debt ceiling, and the dollar will continue to get debased so that debt servicing can be paid, because debt servicing is taking care of the interest on the loans and bonds that they're buying all the time. Then one day, I mean, the Fed is buying, and we have to pay them interest on what they bought. See, then one day a president, this is the good part, will come out on TV and say, today we have defaulted on our loans. We will no longer make interest payments on them. And today we start anew. Your dollars are now a new currency, X, whatever it's named. And this will happen suddenly. There won't be warning. You'll wake up in the morning and there will be. And there'll be nothing you can do about it. If you complain, you might have the National Guard come out and talk to you. So your bank accounts have all been automatically converted to this new currency, and you might notice that you have far less than before. That's the price of default. I actually experienced not default, but the devaluation of the currency when I was living in Mexico. And it happened just that way. You woke up in the morning and the news was out and everything was changed and your bank account was different. And that's the way it was, you know. It really upset me too. But that was mild compared to I only had a certain amount of money in pesos. Not all that much really, but you know, to have everything you have, defaulted like that. But this is in many people's understandings what is going to have to happen eventually. And this writer says, I can't begin to tell you how awful that day might be. And I wonder if someone somewhere will say, but I thought they taught us that deficits don't matter. And, you know, haven't they been teaching us that for a long time? And who's been telling us that besides all these Jewish economists, but the Federal Reserve? Deficits don't matter. We know how to handle that. Hey, don't worry about it. We're experts. We're economists. We're trained. We understand how this stuff works. And we've got it all under control. No, they don't. They never have. Friday, this same person had some other good words, I thought. He wrote, the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben S. Bernanke and his colleagues, meeting next week, are poised to take two steps that appear inconsistent. They will probably lower, you know, there is this meeting supposed to be Wednesday, or the results of the meeting will come out on Wednesday. The meeting might start on Tuesday or something. They talk this up, the Federal Reserve people and boards, and they will probably lower their estimate for growth for this year and next for the third consecutive time in recent time. Simultaneously, they are forecast to start scaling back the $85 billion in monthly bond purchases they have been relying on to stoke the recovery. So what they're saying is that they're going to announce that growth is not as good as they've been telling us, and which was the reason that they were going to scale back on the money creation and putting $85 billion into the economy, into the economy every month to keep things going and to make money available to people and so on, to keep things from stopping altogether. And they're going to do these are two opposite messages. And what's more, annual inflation has been running at least a half percentage point below the Fed's goal since December. And while the employment rate at 7.3% in August is falling, that's because Americans are leaving the labor force. You know, the same old thing. They've quit looking for a job. They quit. Therefore, they're not included amongst those who are unemployed. And this, somebody said, is a communications challenge, meaning how are they going to explain all this? But they kind of, you know, try to wave it away, and people don't pay enough attention and don't think that they understand it, and they trust these people. You know, it's the old thing. Trust us. You know, trust us. We know what we're doing. And just to quickly go to a story in Germany, you know, the elections, the national elections, I believe, are going to take place on Sunday. I think they do their electing, their voting on Sundays. And another misuse of the Lord's Day, some would say. And Merkel already had a big victory in Bavaria this past Sunday, yesterday. And some people are expecting that she might win a majority and won't need a coalition partner in her government, as currently she has the Free Democrats, but is it the free Democrats or some other kind of Democrats, but the business-oriented Democratic, liberal Democrat Party. And some people are hoping that the Social Democrats will get in with her, but I hope not. Anyway, a French liberal member of the European Parliament said, whoever is elected, the constraints that Merkel has faced will remain the same for any German government. Doesn't matter who's in. They want Germany to give more, to be more giving into the Eurozone. And the thing is that the German public, thank goodness, is still hostile to that. So she's dealing in the whole Eurozone who thinks that once Merkel wins the election, she will, you know, come around to what the Eurozone partners want. But she is, still facing a hostile public opinion. And they admit that, you know, and a vigilant constitutional court. So they admit that the public doesn't want to do that. They don't want to give more to their European partners than they already have, and they are already doing. But that's considered, you know, well, we just have to overcome that. She has to overcome that. Well, whoever is elected in Germany has to overcome that. That has to be overcome because, you know, hell with the public, hell with the people and what they want and what they have to say. They pretend like they're paying attention to it. Only until they get elected, and then they turn around and do what the people don't want them to do, and they've got quite a few years in guaranteed, so they're not worrying about it at the beginning of their rule. So they want to Christian Lequesne, another Frenchman, research director at a political science institute, said Germany was becoming like a big Switzerland, accumulating wealth while avoiding international responsibility in crises like Syria or the Eurozone. You see, this is what the other people, and particularly the French, are good at this. They don't do anything. You know, they're worthless. They haven't always been worthless, but they've become worthless because they're not doing well under their new socialist government and new socialist prime minister. They've been doing even, you know, worse and worse. And they are pushing Germany to take care of the problems in the Eurozone. And this Frenchman says Germans have no desire to risk blood or treasure. They are in a zero-risk mindset. Well, why should they be willing to risk their blood and their treasure? Nobody else is doing it. The other countries lose, not all of them, but the ones that need the help, the southern European countries, can't keep their economies together. They can't be successful at it. And they are extravagant, too, in their spending, and they're kind of lazy. And so, you know, they tend to be compared to the Germans and the other Germanic nations. So they are the ones who, if you're going to keep this union together, I guess they're just always going to be on welfare, so to speak. And it comes down to the Germans to pay this welfare. Now, it says here, most Germans share Merkel's view that other Europeans just need to emulate the German model of public and private thrift at home and competitiveness abroad to solve their economic woes. But, you know, the thing is, these other Europeans are not German, so they can't emulate the German model. They can't do it because it's not about the system as they want you to think. Even Merkel wants you to think, well, if they would just, you know, follow what, you know, what we tell them and do it the way we do it, you know, they'll get out of their difficulties. No, they won't, because it's not the style of government or the style of management. It's the people. And so they come out and say, the critics, there is little, if any, inclination to acknowledge that Germany's export-driven economic model, excess savings, and suppressed domestic demand might be part of the problem. Well, it can't be part of the problem unless there's no Germany and there's only Europe, that Germans have to become Europeans and change from the way they are, which makes them has always been a pretty competitive nation, you know, economically and so on. And they have to stop doing that, or else just work for other people and not get the benefit of their own labor and their own energy. The rest of Europe wants Germans to do the heavy lifting and pay the bill, while they dictate to Germans what they can and can't do. Listen to this. I just want to come down here and say that Spain, here's a quote from a Spaniard. Spain really wants a single resolution mechanism fast because there is still uncertainty around its banking sector, which will emerge smaller and less able to lend because it will have to raise more capital. But this is the problem that Spain has. So Spain says we've got to have this single resolution mechanism, which locks everyone into paying whatever debts are needed to be paid, you know, or take care of whatever needs to be taken care of, which is always that it mostly comes from the Germans. So the Germans, it's like having your purse open, and they're able to just reach in there and take what they feel what's needed. And there's no control over it from the German point of view because it doesn't belong to Germany anymore. It's all been turned over to Eurozone needs, and Germans are just Europeans. And this is just one reason why I'm so against pan-Europeanism, but I generally am. And because it's never going to be much different from what we have now. Sure, they'll have there'll be improvements, but it'll still be all for one and one for all, and life doesn't work that way. So I'm going to go on now with my main topic, and I'm going to start with a little recap of the White Rose, which I talked about quite a bit on Saturday. And Patty Goldstein, who called in a couple, I think it was last week on this show, has sent me her copy of The White Rose by Ing Scholl, the oldest sister in the family. And it arrived today in the White Network post office box. She had sent it priority mail, and she just sent it and then wrote to me and told me that it was on the way. Now, I know Goldstein is a Jewish name, and she knows that too, and I guess there's Jews in her father's family, but she seems to be a pretty nice person, and I'm not going to reject her nice gift. And she is, I don't think she has any ulterior motives or anything. She seems to think along the lines that we do, and is kind of sorry that she has this name, Goldstein, because, she's judged by it right off the bat. But I don't really know her, but she's always nice when she's in any of her exchanges. So she has done this. She said she's had this book for a long time. It's not new, but she's sent it to me. And I didn't want to take time away from what I needed to prepare for today's program, so I didn't go off to the post office to get it today. It's kind of a drive. And then I'd have to read it, too. So I'll pick it up tomorrow, and I'll be able to find all the meaningful parts and relay them on Saturday. This is not a difficult book. I looked at it on Amazon. It's like one of these sixth grade reading levels, which the way they write all these Holocaust survivor books, because they want young kids around that age to read them. You know, middle school kids, they want to be reading these books when they're so open to the influence. But she tells me, this is what's interesting about it, she tells me that it reveals that these students were listening to foreign broadcasts nobody in Germany, once the war started, were supposed to be listening to foreign broadcasts, but many people did. Often BBC, a lot of people listened to BBC broadcasts, to make sure they were getting the right kind of news, see what the other side was saying. And I don't know what, you know, others too. And it's because, you know, didn't I say that a lot of what, like, if you read all their leaflets, all six of the leaflets put out by the White Rose, it just reads, it just sounds like the propaganda from the enemy propaganda from the Allies, from the Soviets, from the Poles in Auschwitz. They were putting out, they had a, you know, they had their organization in Auschwitz, mostly communist Poles who are good at organizing, and they had a wireless setups, and they communicated and received and sent to London, and they were sending out all kinds of lying atrocity propaganda. So I'm going to see what it says about that, but that's only natural. I've got some other information that I'm really, it's really just what I had on Saturday, but I didn't organize it in my notes well enough. And when I got to it, I was, I had forgotten what it all meant, and I had got confused about exactly what was meant. That was kind of a messy section of Saturday's show. So I've got it, all organized here. Now I'm going to go through it. And what it was saying was that Hans Scholl was seeking help with, for the White Rose. From this was towards, you know, in 43, toward before they were, not too long before they were arrested, they were trying to expand, you know, and get, you know, more allies to working with them. And he sought help from a certain Lilo Ramdor, Ramdohr, a female, I guess, who was a friend of Alex Schmorell's, the Russian, who was a very good friends with the Harnack family. Well, I think they mean that Lilo Ramdor was very good friends with the Harnack family. And as I said, the Harnacks, or it says in the Wikipedia pages, the Harnacks were involved with communists. So there's a connection there between Schmorell and communists. Not surprising. And Hans also endeavored to establish contact with the Donyanis and the Bonhoeffers, who were close relatives of the Harnacks, the Bonhoeffers. The Bonhoeffers, you know, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Lutheran pastor who was so famous, his family was relatives of the Harnacks who were associated with the communists. So there you go. And we know that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a well-known Lutheran theologian and pastor of a church considered an ethicist, you know, respected and all. He participated in the German resistance all the way to the end. He was involved in helping the July 20th assassination plot, July 20th, 1944, that plot against Hitler, in which the bomb did go off, but it had been kicked into a different position, and so Hitler ended up being protected by a big table leg from it, from the worst of it. But several people were killed. I think at least two or three died, and a bunch of them were injured, some very seriously injured. And these were military doing this to other military, you know, murdering one another, murdering their own military, associates, because they were trying to get at Hitler. And, in this, Bonhoeffer was one of the ones who was rounded up after this, and they found out I can't spend any time talking about it. Maybe I'll go into this on some program. There's a lot of written about it in the Ein Anderer Hitler that's on my website by, translated, from Hermann Giesler's memoir. Which Hermann Giesler spent a lot of time talking one-on-one with Adolf Hitler just in a relaxed atmosphere while they were working on their building plans, their architectural plans. And so I was saying that that Bonhoeffer was arrested. He had been arrested before, but now he was arrested in this roundup after the assassination plot. And he was hanged. And I'm glad he was hanged. He deserved to be hanged. And they did finally get him. I'm glad they got him before the end of the war. That's how I feel about him. Now, one thing, you know, he was an ethicist, supposedly, and we know that these students played up the ethical side of what they thought was a problem with the National Socialist regime. They, you know, it wasn't ethical, and Germany had to be ethical. And Bonhoeffer especially opposed Hitler's persecution of the Jews. He started out with that early in April 1933, 2 months after Hitler was installed. He raised the first voice for church resistance to Hitler's persecution of Jews. Remember, he was a pastor of an important church, and he was, you know, very famous kind of already. And he declared, speaking about the Jews, that the church must not simply bandage the victims under the wheel, but jam the spoke in the wheel itself. Now, this is saying we need to... This fits very well into the sabotage leaflet written by Schmorell that I read on Saturday, or any of them really, because it's not only the sabotage, but that they have to bring the government down. They have to bring the whole regime down. They can't just try to help the victims, who he's thinking of basically as Jews at the time, because it's 1933. And this, again, is the kind of thinking. We can't just complain about it or do minor. We have to destroy this government. We have to bring it to an end. And this is what the White Rose were saying, too, in their leaflets, especially after the first one. Now, Bonhoeffer created the Confessing Church in opposition to the German Christian movement. You know, the German Christian movement was making headway before Hitler ever became chancellor. And they were working on that, to have the German Christian National Church. And because that was gaining some ground, Bonhoeffer created his own church called the Confessing Church, which was, you know, confessing means, in case you don't know, I tend to forget what it means. You know, it means that you confess a certain belief in a certain religion. So a confessing church meant that it was the Church of the Lutheran Confession. And it was, you know, it strictly followed the teachings of Lutheranism. And it did not follow, you know, it wasn't going to be some other kind of a Christian church. And Hitler imposed new church elections in July in 1933 so that they could get some of these people out of there and get these German Christian movement people in if possible. And Bonhoeffer put all his effort into the election, campaigning for the selection of independent non-Nazi officials. But an overwhelming majority of key church positions went to the National Socialist supported German Christians. Of course, they accuse that the Nazis rigged the election or something. But at that time, the Germans were more open to it and were willing to go along with it. But then the Bonhoeffer-type people convinced them that that it was all a very bad idea. So in the end, Bonhoeffer prevailed, and the German Christian movement got stalled and didn't make it. Now, back to another person we mentioned there was Donjanyi, the Donjanyi family, and he comes up too in, as I mentioned Saturday in the July 20th plot, and lots of sedition that he was involved in. And he was half Hungarian. His name was Hans, wasn't it? Hans von Donjanyi. He was half Hungarian, born in Berlin. His father was Hungarian, and his mother German. He became friends with Dietrich and Klaus Bonhoeffer, and he married Dietrich Bonhoeffer's sister Christine. So that, you know, made a tight family connection there. And Bonhoeffer's other sister, or another sister of his, named Sabine, married a Gerhard Liebholz, who was of Jewish descent, a jurist. But he had been baptized as a child, so he was considered Christian, but not by the National Socialists. They considered him Jewish. Now, the Christoph, then I got Christoph, they mentioned a Christoph, and I got that confused with Christoph Probst. And then I realized they weren't talking about him, and I thought, trying to real quick substitute somebody else, but this Christoph they were talking about was Christoph Donjanyi, the son of Hans Donjanyi and Christine Bonhoeffer. He was their son, and somehow he got included in that body of text. And what happened to him was he became a distinguished conductor. Okay, his grandfather was a conductor, and he became a conductor too. Unfortunately, although his father had been executed by the National Socialists, Hans. But then, you know, at the time that they were trying to develop these contacts, they were caught at the University of Munich in February 1943. And that was then the end of the White Rose Society. Now, going on to Hitler's table talk, as you see, I'm gonna skip this part. I might use some of this later. Yeah, there's some I want to read, some parts of it I want to read, but I'm going on to Hitler and the Church. I talked about white nationalisms, I think last Monday. I brought out whether that I thought white nationalists should acknowledge and embrace Adolf Hitler as the unsurpassed leader of the white European people, because no one else had ever risen to the level of doing what he did. And I didn't think he should be, I don't think he should be, you know, set aside as finished, and, you know, because we're not doing well as a movement, or even as white people, by leaving him out of the picture. So, but I will say that it's really more Holocaust revisionists rather than white nationalists who are the ones most likely to reject Hitler. You know, does that seem surprising? It might seem surprising that Holocaust revisionists are far more likely to reject Hitler than white nationalists. But it's not, because I think that, well, I think that a lot of Holocaust revisionists, I've said that it's because they don't want that Hitlerism stuff to poison their revisionist work in the minds of the public and their critics and so on. That's one thing. But I think often they really are more liberal-minded than Hitler and National Socialism. And they prefer a freer, what they consider a freer society than National Socialism. And they think that it's possible. And they're also very often don't want to be anti-Jewish, and they don't want to talk about getting rid of Jews, or that we can't live with Jews. So even though they're Holocaust revisionists, they see the Holocaust as, they're smart people. And they're smart, intelligent people. And when they look at it, they see that the Holocaust is ridiculous and a big lie and couldn't happen. So they're willing to work against it. But that doesn't mean that they are working for anything to do with Adolf Hitler. They would like to get the truth out, but they're not trying to bring any of that back. So that's the way it is with them. And there are lots of people of German ancestry who live outside Germany who reject both Adolf Hitler and National Socialism both. And they They know and write about the problem of the Jews. These are the people who are anti-Jewish, but they're not pro-National Socialist or Hitler. And two of them that came to my mind as I was, you know, writing this was Michael Hoffman, who is a Talmud scholar and writes, you know, in a Holocaust revisionist, but he goes only so far, and then he won't go any further. And he is a Catholic. You know, he's a strong Catholic. His Catholicism is the defining thing for him. And another one is Michael Kohlhaas, who, that's a pseudonym, I'm pretty sure, who often has things at Occidental Observer, but he has a website that's just beautiful. And I love his work, Michael Kohlhaas. And he does great stuff, and he's very, very good about the Jews, anti-Jewish and all, but he has written that, no, Hitler is just out of bounds for him. He doesn't think we would want to go to that at all. So he's German, I'm pretty sure. He's living somewhere in Europe, but not in Germany. But I'm pretty sure he's that, because that's not his real name. I'm pretty sure he's a German person. Maybe from something of his I've read, I'm positive, but I don't remember what it is now. But anyway, I'm trying to bring out that there can be a problem. There can be a difficulty for Catholics if they're serious, take their religion seriously, to embrace National Socialism, which is kind of the subject of tonight's program. In this case, like Kohlhaas, he really champions Christian European civilization. He doesn't just champion European civilization or white civilization or something, but it's Christian, definitely Christian that he thinks is what we need to hold on to and what he admires. And he makes a real good case for that. But Hoffman, as I said, studies has written a lot about the Talmud, and he teaches us about what the Jews are really like and so on. So, that's all very good, you know. But I think generally it's their religion that causes them not to like nationalism so very much. There are Catholics who are nationalists and who do excellent work, very smart, educated. What I'm trying to say is there are some other Catholics who are nationalists that I know, who are really great. They're great, but they take their Catholicism seriously, and while they will go so far as being nationalists, they won't endorse Hitler. And in fact, they have kind of a horror when their associates do, and feel that it taints them if they're associated with them, and they don't like that. So they're very strong. And some of these ones I'm thinking of also are accepting of good Jews, what they call, and they don't have any objection to Jews per se. You know, they know all the things that Jews are guilty of, but they don't want to make it, you know, across the board against Jews. They have Jewish friends. And so, you know, it's their Christianity that causes this. I'm quite sure. So Hitler's government in 1933 signed something called the Reichskonkordat with the Catholic Church. And it guaranteed the rights of the church in exchange for the support of the church. And basically, the church wasn't going to complain about, you know, we're going to go along with Hitler and his government, and constraints on the political activity of the clergy. And that is, the clergy agree that the clergy would not get themselves involved in politics, make political statements, try to become political activists and so on, which clergy had done plenty of in the past. And this was with the Catholic Church only. And this concordant is still in force today. I did not know that, but it is. And the church wants to keep it in force. They like it, but they said that after a while, they said that they didn't think that Hitler's government was, or maybe also the National Socialist Party, were living up to the to what they had agreed to. So we'll see about that. But a few little facts here. Bismarck himself tried to weaken the power of the church in Germany. He felt that the church is pretty strong, very strong in Austria and pretty strong in Germany. And, of course, in Germany, you had both the Catholic and Protestant almost kind of equal in influence. And in Austria is just the Catholics. That Austria was totally Catholic. Oh, you could find some Lutherans, I'm sure. But basically, it was all Catholic. And Bismarck, you know, introduced a kind of liberal, more liberal, not liberal to us, not, you know, not like today's liberal, but a more liberal government, and it had some provisions for the people that would come under the name of welfare, you know, some things that were being done and so on. He wanted a looser, he wanted a, you know, a nicer, gentler nation. And because the church was very powerful there. And so, that was back then. And then Hitler's strong resistance to communism appealed to the church. So that was something in his favor, that the Catholic Church was very concerned about Bolshevism and communism. So on 12th March 1933, the German Cardinal Faulhaber was received by Pope Pius XI in Rome, and on his return back to Germany, he reported this, I'm quoting, "After my recent experience in Rome in the highest circles, which I cannot reveal here, I must say that I found, despite everything, a greater tolerance with regard to the new government. Let us meditate on the words of the Holy Father, who, in a consistory, without mentioning his name," not mentioning the name of Hitler, he means, "indicated before the whole world," this is written kind of funny, "in Adolf Hitler, the statesman, who first, after the Pope himself, has raised his voice against Bolshevism." So he's, this German cardinal was pretty supportive of the Hitler government, and he is saying that when he was in Rome, the Pope spoke favorably of Hitler without mentioning his name, because he also has been the only politician to really raise his voice against Bolshevism. So Cardinal Faulhaber, in April 1933, wrote to Cardinal Pacelli, the future Pope, a month later, advising, that is a month after that statement I just read, advising that defending the Jews would be wrong because that would transform the attack on the Jews into an attack on the church, and because the Jews are able to look after themselves. Now, that's pretty good. You know, he was saying, don't worry about the attitude toward the Jews in Germany now, because if we come to the defense of the Jews, then they'll just come after us, and that'll, you know, be difficult for the church. And also that the Jews could look after themselves. They didn't need our help. Good man, you know. But it says that the latter he believed that because of the impression the April boycott outcome. The April boycott was the one-day boycott called against Jewish businesses in 1933. And it was seen as a Nazi defeat. They use the word Nazi here. Because it didn't really amount to anything. It was only one day, and it didn't hurt the Jews enough. And, you know, this big boycott was going on against all of Germany by U.S. Jews who had, you know, who had announced a worldwide attack and boycott of German goods and so on. And that's what this one-day boycott was about, but it was too weak to accomplish anything. So this Carl, Cardinal Faulhaber was a friend. At the 26 April meeting with Bishop Wilhelm Bernin of Osnabrück, who was a representative of the German Bishops' Conference, and Hitler attended that. This is in April now, 33, the German Bishops' Conference. I guess this is still, we're still dealing with Catholics and not Protestants because they have bishops too. And Hitler wrote, said, "I have been attacked because of my handling of the Jewish question. The Catholic Church considered the Jews pestilent for 1,500 years, put them in ghettos, etc., because it recognized the Jews for what they were. In the epoch of liberalism, the danger was no longer recognized. I am moving back toward the time in which a 1,500-year-long tradition was implemented. I do not set race over religion, but I recognize the representatives of this race as pestilent for the state and for the church, and perhaps I am thereby doing Christianity a great service by pushing them out of the schools and public functions." Well, here was Hitler being very outspoken, bravely so, and saying exactly what he thought and telling the truth. How impressive that sounds to me. Sounds so impressive. And this, you know, this idea that he was trying to fool people and put something over on people and sneak up on, you know, with his policies is just false. He was saying this already in April 1933, and it made a lot of sense. Now, as time went on, in 1933, not too much time, there was a Catholic political party. It was called the Center Party in Germany. And there, the one in Austria was like, they call them the Blacks, but it was, it had a name, but it was, you know, the clerical party that, many, you know, because the priests and clerics were involved in it. They didn't get involved in the politics, you know, in the political parties. And then they wanted the laity to be members of the party too and be, you know, helps, you know, engage in activities and so on and support it, particularly in elections. But so there's all this back and forth about this Center Party. And of course, the National Socialist Party was made itself the only party, once you had the Enabling Act, the only party allowed in Germany. So finally, the Center Party dissolved itself on the 5th of July, 1933, as the concordat between the Vatican and the Nazis. I gotta change that. Between the Vatican and the National Socialists had dealt it a decisive blow by exchanging a ban on the political activities of priests for the continuation of Catholic education. Now, we're going to find that one of the biggest concerns that the church had, for the Catholics of Germany was that they continue to be able to receive a Catholic education, that they receive a religious education. And, Hitler could have, if he wanted to use all the power that he had, he could have just banned everything for Catholics and not given Catholics a break in any way. But he didn't want to alienate all these people, not just the Catholic leaders, which would be bad too, but all the Catholic Germans. So, you know, that's, he never tried to do anything like that. But, they were concerned always about their educational rights. And so they agreed to exchange a ban on the political activities of priests. So priests would no longer get involved in politics, and then they would, continue to have, they would continue guarantee that the Catholic education could go on in both in their own schools and in the regular schools. They would have certain religious classes for Catholics. And so this concordat was initialed in Rome 3 days later by Cardinal Pacelli and von Papen, who was vice chancellor, Hitler's vice chancellor at the time. And it was signed on July 20th. 1933. Funny that it's that date, July 20th, but I think it's just a coincidence. On July 2nd, following the July 20th, no, on July, no, before the signing, the Vatican Daily newspaper had insisted that the Concordat wasn't an endorsement of Nazi teachings. I wonder if they use the word Nazi then, or if this is just what's used in the writing about it since. Some of the most important parts of this Reichskonkordat are Article 16, which specified that bishops must take an oath of loyalty and respect the government whilst ensuring their clergy did the same. Okay, think about that. The bishops of the Catholic Church had to, the ones in Germany, you know, the German bishops had to take an oath of loyalty, and then promise to respect the government and ensure that those under them, you know, the priests, etc., did the same. Then Articles 19 to 25 gave protection to the Catholic educational system. That took up six articles. That was very important to them, as I said. And Articles 31 and 32 related to the issue of Catholic organizations that were devoted exclusively to religious, cultural, and charitable purposes. They were allowed, you know, but if they got political, they were not allowed. They, you know, so they had to stay out of politics. And okay, that's it. And so everything went along pretty well in Germany with the Catholics until in 1937. Suddenly, this Vatican encyclical by Pope Pius XI burst onto the scene. It's called Mit Brennender Sorge, which translates to, in English, to with burning concern. And it was an encyclical written by the Pope specifically to the German Church and the German Reich, I guess, yes. And it was secretly smuggled into Germany from Rome, because they feared that, and I think they rightly feared, that if the German authorities ever had got wind of it, seen it, or knew what they intended to read this in the churches, that they would have taken it. You know, they would have what's that called? Anyway, they would have taken it and destroyed it and censored it and so on. So Pope Pius thought it was necessary to make these statements. So they smuggled it into Germany, and they got some printers. They must have been Catholic printers to print up, you know, thousands of copies, and they put them, you know, they sent them to all the Catholic churches. All of them in Germany. And it was all done secretly, and it didn't get out. And on Palm Sunday, which is on a March 21st that year, and remember this is 1937, on Palm Sunday it was read in all the churches, and one of the busiest Sundays in, you know, in church, on the church calendar, so there'd be a maximum of people there listening to it. And it's pretty long, and nobody was stopped in the middle of reading it, but there was a bad reaction to it. So but this it condemned, basically this encyclical condemned the Reich's breaches of the Reichskonkordat agreement that had been signed, and they criticized Nazism and its elevation of one race above others. Some of the things I want to say about what was in it spoke of God-given rights and invoked a human nature that went beyond national boundaries. It stated that rejection of the Old Testament, which some leaders, religious as well as secular, advocated in Nazi Germany, that rejection of the Old Testament was blasphemous. Okay, it was supporting the Old Testament, because there was all this talk, you know, among the National Socialists, led by Alfred Rosenberg, that the Christian church should use just the New Testament, and we didn't need the Old Testament. The Old Testament was Jewish. The New Testament was, you know, since Christ, and that was good, and we didn't. So, but the Catholic Church hardly defended. They found this very offensive to say that we should not that you could remove the Old Testament. So, and it came right out and criticized racism, pantheism, neo-paganism, and something they called statolatry, which was worship or idolatry of the state. And they defended baptized Jews who had been baptized in the Catholic Church, which National Socialism didn't accept based on their racial theories. And the Roman Catholic Church said it didn't accept these racial theories. That, and Catholics should not accept these racial theories that of the of this movement of the of National Socialism. And then the fact is that one last thing I'll say before we go to our break: this German Cardinal Faulhaber wrote the first draft of this encyclical, and he wanted to be more diplomatic and not be so tough on the Hitler government and try to prevent a breach with the government. But the Pope edited and rewrote what he had, saying that he did so because the true faith must be defended in Germany. So the Pope was pretty serious about this. And when we get back from the break, we'll go on about this and then more table talk. So see you in 5 minutes.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken, im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken, und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Heretics Hour on September 16th, 2013, and the topic is, once again, Christianity and Hitler National Socialism, and are how compatible are they in the long run? Now, we're talking about the Mit Brennender Sorge encyclical, which means with burning concern. This was the beginning of, it began that way, that it was written that it's with great concern and anxiety that it's speaking to the German people, the German Catholics and so on about these issues. And it went on, and I want to point out one thing though, before I go on, that the church, you know, is much weaker today. Both the Protestant church, the Catholic church, any Christian church you want to talk about probably, is weaker today than it was then. It was still a powerful force at that time, and most people went to church and belonged to a church and took their religion. They felt, you know, they wouldn't consider living as as non-believers, or as just not supporting the church, not supporting their church like they do today, where you have people who are kind of like nominal Christians but never get close to a church. Some things about this, explaining this encyclical a little bit more. It condemned particularly the paganism of the National Socialist ideology, the myth of race and blood, and the fallacy of their conception of God. God was a general, you know, idea. That they felt that, you know, National Socialism and Hitler himself talked about God in kind of a general way. But they said that they said that it had to be about Christ. You had to bring Christ into it, or it didn't have any meaning. So it warned Catholics that the growing Nazi ideology, which exalted one race over all others, was incompatible with Catholic Christianity. And that's a pretty strong statement. I mean, it's incompatible with Catholic Christianity. But you have to decide whether you think National Socialism exalts one race over all others. It defends and protects, I think, one race, the race of the people that are that are involved in National Socialism. I mean, it defends and protects the white race. It's concerned with the white race, in all its racial investigations, it did see that particularly the Germanic and the Aryan race was the superior race on Earth. It did. So that's incompatible with Catholic Christianity, according to the thinking of the time, 1930s, Martin Ronheimer writes that whilst Mitt Breninder's Sorge asserts race as a fundamental value of the human community, a necessary and honorable, it condemns the exaltation of race, or the people, or the state, or a particular form of state, above their standard value to an idolatrous level. That is, it's okay to honor and value your own people and so on, up to a certain point. But you go beyond that point, and then it becomes idolatrous. They quote a verse from Isaiah that says, this is coming from the Pope, none but superficial minds could stumble into concepts of a national God, of a national religion, or attempt to lock within the frontiers of a single people, within the narrow limits of a single race, God, the creator of the universe, king and legislator of all nations, before whose immensity they are as a drop of a bucket. So it's rejecting a national religion, a national God, anything to do with being national, and trying to limit things to one nation. According also to this Martin Ronheimer, he said it was Pacelli, who's Pope Pius XI, who added to Foul Haber's milder draft the following passage. Whoever exalts race or the people or the state, this is similar to what I already said, but whoever exalts race or the people or the state or a particular form of state or the depositories of power, or any other fundamental value of the human community, however necessary and honorable be their function in worldly things, that is, how no matter even if the person is very honorable, in worldly, endeavors and so on, but if you, whoever raises these notions above their standard value and raises them to an idolatrous level, distorts and perverts in order of the world planned and created by God. They're emphasizing that God is the, here's the thing though, God is the ultimate decider of things and not men. It's the church that tells you who God is, what God is, what God thinks, what God wants. And I might, say a little more about that later, but it is, they have it all locked up. They're the ones who speak for God. So you have to follow that, well, then they're the ones who are in power. The church is in power rather than these, people representing the governments of their people. And they don't want to lose this. So, against the background to the encyclical, Foul Haber suggested in an internal church memorandum that the bishops should inform the Nazi regime that the church, through the application of its marriage laws, has made and continues to make an important contribution to the state's policy of racial purity and is thus performing a valuable service for the regime's population policy. I thought that was pretty interesting. He was trying to say that in order to, get along better, we should inform the National Socialist regime of how much the church helps them through the application of its marriage laws, because the church had marriage laws, which, didn't allow marriage between inappropriate peoples, and that had to make a contribution to racial purity. That was just Foul Haber always trying to smooth things over between the church and the German government. Now, Hitler's response to this he was quite angry. There was no warning. He was not advised. Of course, if he had been advised, he would have told them they couldn't do it. I'm quite sure he would have said, no, sorry, can't do that. But so they knew that, so they didn't advise him, but they did it in a sneaky way, And they suddenly it there it was, and it was it seemed outrageous, the things that were in it, to because it was a clear condemnation of what the National Socialists and Hitler's government was doing as far as German Catholics are concerned, and breaking their supposedly their pledge in the Reichskonkordat. And somebody named Thomas Bokenkotter writes that in response, the Nazis, here we go with the Nazis again, the National Socialists were infuriated and in retaliation closed and sealed all the presses that had printed it and took numerous vindictive measures against the church, including staging a long series of immorality trials of the Catholic clergy. Yeah, you might think that's going too far, but they were so angry, and he was angry, and they punished those printers who had printed this up for the church, and they closed their businesses and sealed their presses, but more understandably, they went after the morality of the clergy, according to John Vidmar. It included staged prosecutions of monks for homosexuality with the maximum of publicity, and 170 Franciscans were arrested in Koblenz and tried for corrupting youth in a secret trial, with numerous allegations of priestly debauchery appearing in the Nazi-controlled press. While a film produced for the Hitler Youth showed men dressed as priests dancing in a brothel. So they retaliated by pointing out all the bad behavior, immoral behavior of the clergy and the church in Germany, which they probably didn't make it up. It probably was fairly true. But they're able to tolerate what was going on in the church, just as the church was supposed to tolerate what was going on in the government. Well, this changed that. Now, some things here, there's some of the better things from the document I have here that I want to read to give more of a flavor of how it was written. And number 14, there were all these items, I don't know, quite a lot of them, into the 30s. And number 14 was, no faith in God can for long survive pure and unalloyed without the support of faith in Christ. That's where they were, where it was said that you couldn't just talk about God. And you had to support it with Christ, and without Christ it didn't have any meaning. And this had to be, the church had to be able to do this. And 15, the sacred books of the Old Testament are exclusively the Word of God and constitute a substantial part of His revelation. They are penetrated by a subdued light. Nothing but ignorance and pride could blind one to the treasures hoarded in the Old Testament. 16. Whoever wishes to see banished from church and school the biblical history and the wise doctrines of the Old Testament blasphemes the name of God, blasphemes the Almighty's plan of salvation, and makes limited and narrow human thought the judge of God's designs over the history of the world. You know, I read not too long ago, and I haven't seen anything else about it, but it said in this little article that someone in the church had, under the new pope, you know, that South American pope, it was announced that the celibacy of priests was open to discussion. Now, that's how far they're changing. They're not changing about the Old Testament, but to say that suddenly or now that they didn't say they were going to change it, but it was open for discussion. I think they realized that this celibacy is not working very well, and I don't think it's a very good idea. But it's ancient, you know. It goes back, and it's, they have resisted making any change in that. But this new pope is willing to do it. It's kind of, well, I won't go into that right now. So number 34, item 34 in this encyclical, what we object to is the voluntary and systematic antagonism raised between national education and religious duty. That is why we tell the young, sing your hymns to freedom, but do not forget the freedom of the children of God. Do not drag the nobility of that freedom in the mud of sin and sensuality. He who sings hymns of loyalty to this terrestrial country should not, for that reason, become unfaithful to God and his church, or a deserter and traitor to his heavenly country. Just to comment on that, there's more of it, is that they're saying it's fine to sing your national hymns, you know, your national songs, but just don't forget to give God his due, and don't forget about God while you're doing it. Continue to be sons of the church, even while you are loyal to your particular country. Then it goes on to say, you are often told about heroic greatness in lying opposition to evangelical humility and patience. You know, in the schools, in history, and in literature too, there was popular among the students too, to learn about all the great heroes of the past, you know, and the great things that they did and so on. And they'd read about the Greek heroes in literature, and, you know, because they had to learn Greek and Latin and so on. And they'd read all these things in the original. And they studied this, and this church is saying, well, what about the church heroes? What about religious heroes? That's heroism too. They say, why conceal the fact that there are heroisms in moral life? That the preservation of baptismal innocence, by which they mean celibacy, is an act of heroism which deserves credit. Why don't they talk about that? See, they want to show every man who gives up sex for God as being a hero. But, you know, the problem is most of them don't really do it. They just pretend like they're doing it. I mean, this is the problem is the hypocrisy in the church because of these unnatural demands that are made. So they're not all that heroic. But they want to, you know, they want to say that they should be seen that way. And now they might get rid of, who knows, they might be getting rid of celibacy. You are often told about the human deficiencies which mar the history of the church. Why ignore the exploits which fill her history, the saints she begot, the blessings that came upon Western civilization from the union between that church and your people? Well, you know, I think that a lot of these saints, they have been exaggerated what they've done. You know, and a lot of miracles are exaggerated and aren't true. So I'm not a believer in things like this. And the fact is, the more intelligent you are and the more educated you are, the more difficult it is to believe religious things, a lot of these religious myths and so on. Very difficult. So I don't know about the saints. I'm not too impressed. But, you know, when you're young, you're going to be very impressed with all the stories about the saints that they tell. And then that carries over. And as you get older, you just don't quite, you just accept it. You might, you know, doubt a whole lot of things. But you don't talk about it and you go along with it. That's how things are done. Now, the encyclical goes on, you are told about sports. They're really worried about this emphasis on sports. Indulged in with moderation and within limits, physical education is a boon for youth. But so much time is now devoted to sporting activities that the harmonious development of body and mind is disregarded, that duties to one's family and the observation of the Lord's Day are neglected. With an indifference bordering on contempt, the day of the Lord is divested of its sacred character against the best of German traditions. Well, I'm not unsympathetic to that, because there's you can get so removed from any kind of this, well, sacrifice. But the church wants you to sacrifice for what they say, you know, is God, and the National Socialist regime wanted you to sacrifice for your nation and your people. That's the difference there. And the church worries about that. They don't want that to, you know, they don't want to lose what they have. And they say, but we expect the Catholic youth in the more favorable organizations of the state to uphold its right to a Christian sanctification of the Sunday, not to exercise the body at the expense of the immortal soul, not to be overcome by evil, but to aim at the triumph of good over evil. Just lost my place here, so I'm moving. Then 21, item 21, is as its highest, let's see, yeah, as its highest achievement will be gaining of the crown. Oh, that's no, that's Romans 21 in the Bible. Sorry about that. I had to switch from one page to another. It says, but not to be overcome by evil, but to aim at the triumph of good over evil as its highest achievement will be the gaining of the crown in the stadium of eternal life. The stadium of eternal life rather than the sports stadium. So, Hitler had no interest. I want to point out here. I wonder what I got here. G7. Okay. you know, the concern that the church had about paganism in some of the National Socialist writings and teachings and so on, Hitler had no interest in paganism. And when people bring up the Serrano esoteric Hitlerism by that writer, his last name is Serrano, it's just baloney if you want to connect Hitler with it, because there's no esoteric Hitlerism unless you just dream, you know, you just want to think that on your own. But Hitler would not share it with you. He often said the idea of returning to Wotan or Votan was preposterous. He said it didn't interest him, and it wasn't going to interest the people. It was too far back. Nobody could go back to that, and it's just didn't appeal. And he liked science, as I said before. He believed in nature with a capital N, and that if you looked to and studied how nature's not just nature's laws, but how nature managed to preserve peoples and increase, you know, people to increase and grow and become more powerful, more dominant. The way nature did it was really the only effective way. Let the weak overcome the strong. You couldn't allow the weak to outnumber the strong and the capable. And he also liked the arts, as we know, very much so, being an artist too, and had a great appreciation of and understanding of art and all the arts, though. Visual art, painting, sculpture, and music, and architecture. He was quite the Renaissance man, and he liked intelligent discussion and conversation, and, you know, intelligent people sharing their views like they were doing around the dinner table in table talks. But the fact is that everybody thought Hitler was so much more intelligent than they were and had better things to say that they were, kind of silent. So he just kept talking and they just listened for the most part, because what they had to say wasn't up to the level of what he had to say. Now, let's see. I've got this. Let me see if I'm on track here. Wow, I've got this thing. Pope Pius to the German faithful. I know what this is. This is more in more depth, not in more depth, but in more detail. some of the things in the Mitt Brennender Sorge that I had copied down before, and some of it is in bold, so let me take a look at that and read some of this. Well, I already did. This is a big part about the Old Testament and how important it was and so on. And then that's about the Old Testament too. Gospel of item 22. Here's about the German, National German Church. It says, should men who are not even united by faith in Christ come and offer you the seduction of a national German church? Should these men who are not even united by faith in Christ, that is, you know, these Germans, the German officials in the National Socialist Government, should they come and offer you the seduction of a national German church? Be convinced that it is nothing but a denial of the one Church of Christ and the evident betrayal of that universal evangelical mission for which a world church alone is qualified and competent. And that speaks definitely for universalism, that there's a world church for all the world and everybody in the world belongs to it. That's the idea of Catholicism, but that's the idea of Protestantism too, that everybody in the world belongs, because there's one God over, you know, and every church wants to be representative of the one true God. Here's more about race and blood. Revelation, in its Christian sense, means the word of God addressed to man. The use of this word for the suggestions of race and blood, that is, that there's a there's a revelation about it, for the irradiations of a people's history, is mere equivocation. False coins of this sort do not deserve Christian currency. Faith consists in holding as true what God has revealed and proposes through his church to man's acceptance. 24 is immortality in a Christian sense means the survival of man after his terrestrial death, for the purpose of eternal reward or punishment. Whoever only means by the term the collective survival here on earth of his people for an indefinite length of time distorts one of the fundamental notions of the Christian faith and tampers with the very foundations of the religious concept of the universe, which requires a moral order. So this affects those who talk about our interests are in our people surviving, and we survive. These are the non-religious people. We survive through our progeny, you know, our people surviving on and on into the future, indefinite length of time. And this is a total distortion, the Pope says, of the Christian faith, which is about the survival of each individual man or woman after terrestrial death for the purpose of gaining an eternal reward or a punishment. I don't know if there's eternal punishment, but there's punishment. And you know, that fits to something else. All right. Many of you clinging to your faith and to your church as a result of your affiliation with religious associations guaranteed by the Concordat have often to face the tragic trial of seeing your loyalty to your country misunderstood, suspected, or even denied, and of being hurt in your professional and social life. If the state organizes, they're saying, you know, that your religious associations have been guaranteed by this Concordat, and you're being disappointed in that. Because if you stick with just these religious associations, your professional life suffers or your social life suffers. And it goes on to say, if the state organizes a national youth, which it does, and makes this organization obligatory to all, Then, without prejudice to rights of religious associations, it is the absolute right of youths as well as of parents to see to it that this organization is purged of all manifestations hostile to the church and Christianity. And finally, in this little section here, again about the sporting activities, you are told about sports. I think I already read this, though. Yeah, I did. That they spend too much time with sports and not enough, neglect the Lord's Day and so on. And then the educational system again. An educational system which systematically works against religion, which they say the state schools do, that they have religious lessons maintained for the sake of appearances. See, you had the religious schools, but then you had the regular schools, and they were supposed to provide religion classes and proper religion classes for Catholic students. But they say they didn't do them well. They were sloppy and they were neglectful in these classes in the regular schools. And a lot of parents chose to send their children, Catholic parents chose to send their children to the regular schools, probably because they were free, and also because they were supposed to get the religious training that they needed. And maybe these parents didn't think that their children needed, they got enough religious training in church things, and they didn't need to get it in school too. I don't know. But the church didn't like this. So they say that the religious lessons maintained for the sake of appearances, controlled by unauthorized men within the frame of an educational system that basically works against religion. So, you know, they would have these classes, but the people who were teaching them weren't qualified, and they were not really for Catholicism or the Catholic values, and so they worked not in favor of the church or but against it. Oh, we know, dear Catholic parents, that your vote was not free, or a free and secret vote would have meant the triumph of the Catholic schools. Well, I guess they voted for the state schools, a lot of Catholic parents, but the church is saying that their vote, they said elsewhere that the vote was rigged, and that it wasn't a fair vote, and that the parents would not have voted that way, and I don't know if that's... Now, I want to go back up to the table talks, and there's a few... I covered a lot of it on Saturday, but there's a few that I didn't that I'd like to mention, I'd like to read, that I think are pretty important and comment on a little bit. And I just want to say that right now, if anybody wants to call in about this subject and make a comment, I'll take your call as soon as I, if you do call, give me a few minutes to read these last things from the table talks, and then the number is 1-830-443-4911. the 300 on page 325, and this is in the Chaim edition only. And the Chaim edition is the best, supposedly the best one, the most reliable. Some of these are from in both Chaim and Picker, which is good. This one is only in Chaim. Hitler said, "Since my 14th year, I have felt liberated from the superstition that the priests used to teach. Apart from a few holy Joes, I can say that none of my comrades went on believing in the miracle of the Eucharist. The only difference between then and now is that in those days, I was convinced one must blow up the whole show with dynamite." Well, you know, that sounds pretty authentic to me, and that's about the way it went with Hitler. He was he was very impressed by the church and so on in his youth. And in fact, he says in Mein Kampf that because the priest and the church was the grandest thing, you know, in the village that he lived in, He thought about the highest aspiration he could have was to become a priest, and he was thinking about that. And he liked, you know, he liked it all. I always liked church. I particularly liked a lot of the stuff in the Catholic Church when I was young. There was a lot of things to look at, you know, in there, statues and paintings and so on. And all those costumes, you know, robes and things, all that's kind of impressive and makes for a change from everyday life. But he says when he was 14, he no longer believed it. He was liberated. He felt liberated from it. And that's about the right age. You know, that's like eighth grade in the United States, that you around that time, you start thinking about it. You could question it before then, but mostly you just don't even you're just pretty much satisfied to go along. If you go to church, I didn't go to church on any regular basis, so I didn't have to rebel from anything. But I know that in the eighth grade and also the ninth grade, I had quite a few experiences where it just became clear to me that I didn't believe this stuff. And I don't mean to be putting it down. I'm friendly to Christianity. I really am. And I think that what most of us do is we just tolerate one another. I mean, the Christians, or if you're Catholic, you tolerate, like if you were in a National Socialist government, you tolerate that and you still, follow your church teachings, but maybe you don't take them all that, you know, to any extreme. So you can live in both systems by just letting things pass that aren't, you consider not too important, not trying to answer every question or make everything make, you know, total sense. And the same way with National Socialists, who are very, you know, turned on to National Socialism, say those in Germany at that time, and they still were Christians and they still went to church and their families went to church and so on. And, they just didn't let these discrepancies bother them. But the church itself, when it comes to down to the, nitty gritty, it's the fact of a power conflict, well, they both want to be ultimately powerful in this society. Now, the church is pretty much, today, this might be a little outdated because the Catholic Church probably doesn't expect to be anymore. It knows it can't be, but it does try to influence, the governments as much as possible. And it does absolutely try to protect its rights and protect, the Catholic institutions and so on in every country in the world. But I'll say that, let's see, going on with this. This is, no, okay, in on page 341 then, in this is both Heim and Picker, he says, Hitler says quite a few things, but I'm just going to read this part. I shall never believe that what is founded on lies can endure forever. I believe in truth. I'm sure that in the long run, truth must be victorious. I like that. I believe that's absolutely, that is Hitler. He would say that. He hated lies. He did believe in truth. He told the truth. Sometimes in political maneuvering and so on, he couldn't tell the absolute truth, or you don't tell, you know, what everything that you're going to do. But he never really lied about it. He was more truthful than any other world leader or national leader that was important at the time. And he says that he's sure, you know, as he's speaking, you know, and casual, you know, without he's not speaking to any, you know, anybody, anything but his friends there. That truth, he's sure that in the long run, truth must be victorious. It must be. It has to be. That's what we all believe. It's probable, he says, that as regards religion, we are about to enter an era of tolerance. Everybody will be allowed to seek his own salvation in the way that suits him best. Now, this also fits him, because he didn't like dictating to people. He didn't want to force people to do anything. In Germany and in the party and in the government, he was always trying to explain to people what was at stake, so that they would willingly, voluntarily on their own, understand what needed to be done and would make good decisions about it and would do it. He didn't want to have to tell everybody what to do every damn minute, you know, and tell every single step that they should take and give the detailed instructions. He didn't want to do that. And he's often faulted for not being dictatorial enough. At the same time, he's, you know, accused of being the world's worst dictator. So, but the real Hitler, believed in freedom, except, freedom of people to think for themselves and to do what they thought was best within the constraints of your national interests and your, as a nation. And Germany was in a battle the whole time. I mean, all of his life, you know, but particularly, from the time the war started, you know, whereas he knew that, and then, you know, he knew that he should try to save Germany from its enemies and have it, you know, be able to stand proud and strong and be intact. A lot of things had to be done, and people had to cooperate with that. It wasn't a thing where you could just have people going off doing whatever they felt like. So that was the only part in which strong laws and measures had to be taken. So he says, in acting as I do, I'm very far from the wish to scandalize, but I rebel when I see the very idea of providence flouted in this fashion. I think he means, he's talking about, he's talking about lies. He says, it's a great satisfaction for me to feel myself totally foreign to that world. I think he means the world of the church, the world of organized religion. I think that's what he means, of the church. It comes out that there's a lot of dislike in Hitler for church. He says, but I shall feel I love this part. He says, even though, you know, he feels totally foreign to the world of the church, but I shall feel that I'm in my proper place if, after my death, I find myself, together with people like me, on some sort of Olympus. I shall be in the company of the most enlightened spirits of all times. I can relate to that. He used to talk to Geisler, at least I know. He said this idea of sitting around with intelligent people and having, like, discussions and talking about things. This was one of the things he liked best in the world. And he and Geisler were designing his retirement home, which was going to be built on the top of a hill across the river, across the Danube River from Linz, overlooking the city of Linz, his favorite, is what he considered his hometown that he was making very beautiful. And it was going to have this room with a big round table. He called it the round table. And he was going to invite, he was planning to invite people there to come and sit around and have discussions with him. And they would talk about all kinds of interesting things. And he said to Geisler, you'll be invited too. And, he was just a great person. He says, if my presence on earth is providential, which you see, he knew it was, but he didn't say it was. He said, if it is, I owe it to a superior will. That's the way that he bowed to God. And this is what was not acceptable to the Catholic Church. And wouldn't have been, I don't know if it had been acceptable to the Protestant Church either, I guess. But he knew that there was something superior to him, and that he was under the will of this greater thing. And he was willing to be under that will and to serve, you know, that, because he thought it was good. And that was God to him. I mean, that was the same as God, I think. And he went on to say, but I owe nothing to the church that traffics in the salvation of souls. And I find it really too cruel. Trafficking in the salvation of souls, he finds really too cruel. You know what that is. That is what he's referring to is that the church determines whether your soul is saved or not. And they tell you if you do this, that, you know, remain faithful to the church, you know, come to Mass, partake in the sacraments, support the church, support the clergy, contribute to the church, bring up your children in the church, make sure that all of this is in good order, and then get the final sacrament before you die. Then you are sure to be admitted into heaven because, you know, they had the keys to that. They held the keys to heaven. And if you supported them all your life, you would get into heaven. And that's how, in a sense, you know, they keep their temporal power. They said they were only interested in spiritual power, but they really were very interested in temporal power too. You have to be. And they were. And Hitler says of this kind of, you know, dealing with if they're the arbiters of whether your soul is saved or not. I admit that one cannot impose one's will by force, but I have a horror of people who enjoy inflicting sufferings on others' bodies and tyranny upon others' souls. So he saw this as a tyranny, and he didn't want to be under it, and he freed himself of it when he was 14 years old, he says. And our epic will certainly see the end of the disease. This upsets him so much that it caused him to use the word disease. And he then said, our epic will certainly see the end of the disease of Christianity. It will last another 100 years, 200 years perhaps. And that's where, you know, as I talked about on Saturday, and I have given some of my own views here. Couldn't help it, I guess. But I'm really just trying to look for what Hitler actually believed and said. And he just thought that Christianity was not gonna last. But it would take a while. And you know, we know today that it's not what it was. In Western civilization, religion, organized religion, none of them have the power that they did have. Now, plenty of us say that the Jews are behind that, and the Jews are destroying Christianity. They would like to do that. They do try to do that. But that doesn't mean that it is, we have to look at what part of it you'd want to save and what you wouldn't want to save. So, I guess I've got 10 minutes. Again, I say, if anybody wants a call, I know that there are people who, are really upset by this kind of thing. But I think that we have to look at it. Okay, this is my thinking here, why I'm getting into this. That we talk about, I talk about National Socialism a lot. And now everybody is not a National Socialist, but there are plenty of people who, if they're not National Socialists, they're racialists, okay? So amongst those of us who believe in these things, we believe in racialism, and there's a lot of following of the white race and promoting of the white race and so on. And yet the Christian churches do not. We say, well, it's the modern Zionist churches. You know, they're all catering to the Jews. Well, we find that the Christian church has always catered to the Jews, even though, as Hitler said in the beginning, in this one little excerpt from his talk to the British, to the German bishops, that there was a time, I don't think I can find that now, but there was a time when the church got rid of the Jews and didn't allow the Jews, was very anti-Jewish, knowing what the Jews were. And now they don't do that anymore. But he does it. He understands the racial question. He said the church used to understand the racial question, but it doesn't anymore. So, and it seems that it has gotten more and more that way, hasn't it? Because the church is weaker in the face of the Jews today than it was in Hitler's time. But then they said, no, we cannot persecute the Jews. And that was the biggest complaint of the churches in National Socialist Germany, was the persecution of the Jews, both the Protestant and the Catholics. And the Catholics were slower about it, and a lot of them didn't really want to complain about it, but they had to. They finally had to, and the Pope and the Catholics in other countries, you know, were making a lot of noise about it. So they had to go along with it and defend the Jews. So this is not something. How do you if you're a believer, if you're a follower of your religion, let's say you're a Catholic, and I mentioned a few Catholics and talked about them, how they can't go all the way with either National Socialism or racialism. They can't quite do it. And that's, I think, because if you are a follower of your church, it goes against that so much to embrace these ideas. You can't do it. So that limits your ability to go all out for the defense of the white race, I think. As long as you say, well, it's okay if we have Jews around, and it's okay if we see all races as equal. It's okay if these races are in our nations, and it's okay because in the end, I want to save my soul, and God only sees us as souls. He doesn't see our physical appearance, so he doesn't care about that. He doesn't care about things like race. We care about it, and the church says it's okay to care to some degree, but there's a limit to how much you can care about it. So this puts a difficulty there that I think simply has to be acknowledged. I do not like the anti-Christians who talk very sneeringly and nastily about Christians and have to insult them and so on. I don't go along with that at all. And I don't like Christians who talk about pagans and insult, you know, as though they're, you know, the scum of the earth or something, and ignorant and wrong. But it's what it is your highest loyalty, if you're a Christian, goes to God and Christ. It has to. If you're not a Christian, you can put your highest loyalty with your people and your leaders and be satisfied with that. You know, I have to admit that it's hard to say that leaders are all that good. There aren't any good enough leaders. See, the Germans were fortunate in Hitler. They were smart enough to know that they were fortunate. They were smart enough to know that they had somebody that they could put their faith in and they could trust. We are disappointed again and again, and then people die, and Hitler would have died too. If things had turned out differently, he still would have died. And no matter how much, you know, how good of a system, organization he left behind, it was still vulnerable to all kinds of problems. But if you put all your faith in God, and in Christ, you're putting your faith in something supernatural. And you know it's a kind of a blind faith, and so you're not gonna be concerned as much about getting the best leaders, because you know there's this conflict there. It doesn't work out. That's all I'm saying. What we see in the Third Reich was that it came to a conflict. You know, they tried to work it out in the beginning with the Reichskonkordat and with the German National Church, with the Protestants and so on. They tried to work all these things out, but they didn't succeed in it. Somehow they didn't, they didn't work. And there were problems later. And then you had the White Rose Society, which was just a few of these young kids. Or, you know, they weren't young kids, these young people. Just a few people, but they were in the spirit of this general resistance, which was, often associated and led by, religious leaders. And this, weakened the Reich. It weakened the unity that was so necessary, even though still most people were in total support of it. Probably near total, but you had enough people that were causing trouble, and they did cause a lot of trouble in the war effort, because a lot of these were military leaders. So it's just a question that I'm bringing up, that I thought we didn't need to deal with it. You know, I didn't need to deal with it. It was Christians could be Christians and they'd still be racialists and so on. But if you're loyal to a church, the church will want to dominate in your life. And I think, in my opinion, I prefer to have political policies dominate in my life. And hope it would be nice if we had a real strong organization and leadership, which we don't have. But if we did, I'd prefer to have that be dominant in my life. And so there you go. And anybody else can talk about it in whatever way they want to talk about it. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about the White Rose. And remember to listen to the Age of Treason radio in the tomorrow night. And then on Thursday, Hattie Scott and I on the International. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.